we only have one. We should only have one special interest now, and that's like our overall environment. And
right.
Our overall environment's where it needs to be, mm-hmm. and the habitat in our overall environment is where it needs to be. These mm-hmm. species will all find their place.
Hey there, and thanks for tuning in to episode 25 of the Maritime Outdoorsman Podcast. Today, happy to be connecting with a good friend of mine, instrumental guy in conservation efforts here in the Maritimes, Danny Ripley. Danny is a custom fly tier. He does fly casting instruction. He guides for trout, salmon, stripers. You can check the show notes at maritimeoutdoorsman.com/025. And in there, I'm going to have a link to Danny's website, which is Stream Born Outdoors. So you can, if you want to connect with Danny, you can do that just by going to the show notes and clicking on that link. Yeah, so I'm really looking forward to talking with Danny today. He and I actually had similar upbringings with one aspect of our life. We both, in our younger years, ended up fishing striped bass in the Annapolis Basin region of Nova Scotia. We didn't really know each other. I think our paths crossed a little bit, but we had the same experiences to a degree. And so Danny and I are going to go down memory lane. We're also going to address a couple of the current issues that he and I see with striped bass populations currently. So sit back, enjoy the show, and thanks for listening. Hey, I just wanted to take a minute now to thank my friends at Flowers River Lodge, Hawk River Outfitters, and Crooks Lake Lodge for sponsoring today's episode. If you haven't been to Labrador to any of these three lodges fly fishing for trophy Atlantic salmon or brook trout, I would highly encourage you to take a look. Just go to maritimeoutdoorsman.com/Labrador and find out everything you need to know there. So yeah, I got Danny Ripley on the line. Again, I should say, because we attempted this once before. It went so well, in fact, that I think we went a little too long. So we're gonna try and keep our trip down memory lane, to around the half hour mark today. How you doing today, Danny?
Good, Dave. How are you, bud?
Awesome. So, as of the time of this recording, it's November 2017. How was your summer and your fall?
Summer and fall were good. We had a lot of low water conditions on the angling front, this year. So it was kind of a quiet year. I didn't probably fish as much as I normally do in the freshwater side.
Right.
Through the summer months, did a little bit of saltwater stuff. Saltwater fishing is less affected by the river water level and stuff like that. and then in the fall, I didn't fish as much either. In October, I fished some fall salmon, but we had really low water. Lots of fish around the River Phillip, but not a lot of water. So we're getting a little bit of rain now, so hopefully that'll put those fish up in the spawning grounds. And too late for the fishing, but on time to get them to where they need to be.
That's true, yeah. Yeah, and that seems to be the way it's been the last few years or so, and good for the fish, yeah, like you say, but makes it a little tough when you wait all summer to do that in the fall.
Absolutely, a lot of people really look forward to it, myself included. And, it's one of those things. It's one of those things that's out of your control, so we just play the hand we're dealt.
Exactly. Yeah, no question about that. So we connected. I think it was even really early this year sometime to try and record this. And I didn't really get to know Danny too much until probably my 20s, actually probably late 20s, early 30s. And come to find out that, our paths crossed in our teen years. I don't even remember actually meeting you in the Annapolis Royal area, but our paths definitely crossed. We shared, a lot of the same experiences with regards to striped bass, which is what we're going to talk about today. Lots to talk about. The last time I think we started throwing out names of everybody that we knew and all that. We'll do that again. We'll do that again for sure. So the striped bass, it was primarily the Annapolis Basin and Annapolis River area that you fished when you were, what, in your teens?
I started probably preteens, actually, going down. Probably started going down in about 85 or 86 is when I first started going. My dad had started going down in the late 70s. So I kind of fished, and similar to you, I guess what would be the back end of the heyday down there, I would say, and missed probably the main part of the heyday, which was, I guess, would run probably from the early 70s into the early 80s. But we had some pretty good fishing down there when I went, and I went in the time of the I started going down the time of the power generating station. I'd never fished there pre-generating station like my dad did, but I started going down just after that started operating, and a lot of people started talking about changes pretty quickly after that went in. And but we had some pretty good fishing there for a number of years, but I guess sadly it's not the case down there now.
No, it doesn't seem to be. I mean, there's significantly less anglers even trying for them, I guess. I've heard rumors of different tributaries along the Bay of Fundy that produce from time to time, but yeah, not like what I think we experienced back in those times. And yeah, we were lucky to do so. I mean, where we're at today, the stripers, there's another population on the Northumberland. I believe there's a population, what, in the St. John?
Yeah, well, the population in the St. John River is, well, I guess would be part of that Bay of Fundy side. In that Bay of Fundy strain of stripers, and the Bay of Fundy, from my understanding, and probably similar to your understanding over the years. I remember the last several years that I was down there to fish, there was several biologists, striped bass biologists coming up from the U.S. to study the stripers in the Annapolis River and the Bay of Fundy in general. And I guess the general information from them was that we had some stripers coming up into the Bay of Fundy from the Hudson River population, because the U.S., I guess, from my understanding, is broken down to two: the Chesapeake Bay population, the Hudson, are the two main populations down there. So we get some of the Hudson fish up in the Bay of Fundy, Gulf of Maine area, and then of course Nova Scotia does have its own breeding populations on both the Northumberland Strait side and the Bay of Fundy side, although the Bay of Fundy side spawning success is not as nowhere as near as good as it used to be.
And we're one of the things where we're at today is the striped the population on the Northumberland, which when I started fishing them back in the late 90s, was on a sharp decline. That's since come back and kind of brings with it a great fishery, but at the same time also some issues, as we both know, with regards to salmon and that kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I fished at the time we were fishing in the Annapolis Valley. We also fished the Northumberland Strait stripers, and which on average run smaller than the Bay of Fundy fish. When I started fishing the Northumberland Strait stripers when I was young, the population was already in its decline stage, and it did decline rapidly. And to the point where, like, there was, basically none. The fishery shut down, and I went from there. And now, I mean, we're seeing a huge success story on the striped bass as part of the Northumberland Strait. Like you said, that brings with it some other, issues, and which we hear a lot about now. And it remains to be seen if those fears are actually real or not. A lot of people feel that they're real. I personally holding out to see what happens. I did 15 years of work in salmon restoration and salmon management issues with the Cumberland County River Enhancement Association up here. So doing a lot of habitat work, a lot of meetings for different management scenarios and things like that. And, you know, even from my salmon experience, personally for me, and maybe I'll take some flack for this, but they're not a high level of concern for me right now.
Right.
I find it pretty hypocritical to fault one native species for making a comeback and try to scapegoat another species' problems on, another native species that was virtually gone and has now made a strong comeback.
Right.
Not saying there isn't some issues there.
Yeah.
Potentially the studies that I've seen so far don't indicate the problems that we hear about a lot, talked about around the riverbanks and the coffee shops and tackle shops. But, so like I said, the jury's still out for me on that, and that's my own personal take, and, go from there. I'll take whatever flack comes for having that stance.
Well, unfortunately, it's hard to take a stance on anything nowadays, especially with social media and all that. But I share the same view. I mean, striped bass, there's no question as far as fish angling species go, was my first true love, right? And there were many days and years that I dreamed that maybe the population would come back enough in some location in the Maritimes where we could take our kids and they could catch
one.
And that's happened, right? So
absolutely.
Just this summer I had my boys up in Pictou County. And back in the late 90s, when my wife and I first got together, we caught the tail end of the decline of that fishery up there, and then it was closed. And we were like, man, and then we had kids, and we were thinking, be great if we could someday do that. And it wasn't that far away. My kids are 11 and 5, and they both caught stripers this summer, right? So. You're right to blame one, the rebound of one native species on the decline of another. When we know, we know all too well that the Atlantic salmon have a lot of serious issues and a lot of those we don't even fully understand. So.
Well, absolutely. And the other point I'll make in my position on that is, I have lots of different experiences, some long, some short. No matter how long my experience is on any particular thing, I'll never try to say I know it all for sure. There's only one certainty in life, is that no matter what you do or no matter how long you live, if you ever think you know it all, well, you're kind of dead in the water. And that's one of the philosophies I've always lived by. Mm-hmm. But my stance on the striped bass issue is such as this. I actually, striped bass fishing, I grew up, it was one of my loves in fishing, and just like Atlantic salmon fishing is. Mm-hmm. And I was Atlantic salmon fishing before I was striped bass fishing. I started beating around salmon rivers with my dad when I was 4 and 5 years old, and got my starts there in rivers like the St. Mary's and other rivers like that. Mm-hmm. And, those rivers were in trouble before any of the stuff that we want to talk about as being an issue. So,
for sure.
And you can you look at the different declines, and to me, talking about one species is having impact on something like salmon. It's become like a flavor of the week. One time it was seals, another time it was cormorants, another time it was mergansers. Now it's striped bass.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, next month, next year could be something else. So,
that's right.
But the fact is that the salmon has had issues for a long time, and that for me too, I've kind of been out of the salmon game for a few years now.
Right.
One of the things that I'm not so convinced of now is, is special interest for any one species the way of the future for management and looking after these things. I think really we should only have one special interest now, and that's like our overall environment. And
right.
Our overall environment is where it needs to be, and the habitat in our overall environment is where it needs to be. These species will all find their place,
right?
In my opinion. So
exactly. Well, and there's no question that there's major environmental issues going on. I mean, it was This is November, November 7th, and it was 20 something degrees yesterday down here. So it's concerning. It's not good for a lot of our species and everything going on. But The stripers are an important part of the ecosystem here in the Maritimes, and we'll let the biologists that are currently working on it, figure out what needs to be done, I guess, right?
Absolutely, with input, and they'll seek input when needed.
Sure.
We'll go from there, and ultimately the chips are going to fall where they may anyway. And mm-hmm. I look at all the different management and stuff I've done with salmon over the years, and all the work we've done, and there's been lots of great work done, lots of great projects done. I've mm-hmm. been involved in a lot of them myself on the River Shelf and other rivers, and a lot of the really good and smart people have been involved in a lot of other projects on other watersheds, and those projects have all had impacts, but here we are. We're still where we're at. So, mm-hmm. I mean, for me, in terms of all that stuff, I think it's time to start looking in another direction, because mm-hmm. although we've had successful projects, it's time to start looking at other ways, because our wins are not outpacing our losses. So it's time to look at another strategy, in my opinion.
Right.
The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. And I think we're kind of there.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. There's no question about that. No, those are good points. So I guess while we're on the striped bass topic, we will go down memory lane for a few minutes, and maybe some of the listeners will, I don't know, maybe some of the listeners have experienced what we have. I don't think there were a whole lot. I mean, most of the people I think that you and I ran into down in the Annapolis Basin region in our earlier years were significantly older than us. I mean, we're both there with our fathers who are obviously older, were all older than us. But I mean, we got to experience something that I don't think that many people have. I mean, just the sheer number and size of some of those striped bass, pre the decline, what was your personal biggest, striped bass that you caught or saw somebody else catch while you were there?
My personal biggest is in the 40 pound bracket that I've landed. And, we've landed several mm-hmm. fish in the 40s and mm-hmm. 40 pounds, lots of fish in the 30 pound range mm-hmm. and lots and lots of fish in the 20s mm-hmm. and a tremendous amount of fish in the teens and then a lot of fish sub double digit figures of 10, mm-hmm. It used to be that the average used to be, if you caught a fish in down there in Annapolis, it probably wasn't going to be under 5 or 6 pounds.
Yep.
And then usually a lot of the fish ran in the 10 to 13 pound bracket. And then of course you get jumped up in the 16 to 18 pound bracket a mm-hmm. lot. And then you went over 20s and into the 30s. But, a lot of fish in all those different size brackets, but, we used to go down different times a year to target different sections of that watershed for different reasons. Mm-hmm. And, springtime, a lot of fish, which is a practice we stopped later on, was we used to go fish live Gaspereau early on in the spring when the big cows were coming up to spawn. Mm-hmm. And I seen, hindsight, we caught some pretty big bass that way. And we didn't really fish that way for a long time. We did it, but a lot of guys did a lot, but I've seen a lot of big cows meet their demise, and a lot of those fish are really old. And,
mm-hmm.
and that practice eventually was those area sections of the rivers were closed, and then you transition to summer where we're fishing a lot of, lures, bucktails, mm-hmm. Rapala, Cisco kids, and trolling, and topwater poppers, and,
mm-hmm.
Stuff like that, and then transition into the, in the August the mackerel run, and September the herring run, and then into October our last trip of the year always used to be in October for a weekend, or at least a week long weekend a week, and we go down and again intercept the big fish when they're dropping back out of the river mm-hmm. to go back out to the bay for over winter.
Mm-hmm.
We used to get a lot of big fish at that time, so a lot of different size fish a lot of different times of year, but the biggest I've ever seen down there was 66 pounds.
That's crazy.
And seen several fish in the 50 pound bracket mm-hmm. landed as well by some mm-hmm. really, really skilled anglers.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat. Didn't get as many numbers of big fish as you guys did. I think you guys probably put more time in as well, but caught numerous, 20s, and my personal biggest was 33. My dad, actually, I might as well tell that story. I'm sure it'll inspire some other stories that you got. But that one, we were trolling, which we didn't do a whole lot of, but most of the time we were casting, plugs at night in the heavy current, which you were doing as well. But we had heard that a lot of the bigger fish were being caught upriver trolling live eels, and we had never done that. We didn't know how to get eels. We didn't have a source for that, so we went up, put the boat in, and up at Hebb's Landing, and then we were trolling rubber eels, and we ran into a couple guys in another boat upriver, a couple bends, who were just landing about a 12-pounder, I think it was, and they called us over, and they said, I remember it specifically. One of the guys said, "What are you using?" So I held up the rubber reel. He goes, "Ah, use rubber reels. You'll catch rubber fish. Swing your line over." So he cut the rubber reel off. He put a treble hook on, not a huge one, but a pretty decent size one. And he had this, and then he hooked this live eel through the lips and just said, "Drop it in the water and keep going." And it was one of those magical experiences, because it wasn't two bends in the river. I think it was just up past the elastic plant, and I was holding the rod while Dad, manned the motor, and all of a sudden it felt like I just hooked bottom, and I seriously did. I thought I hooked bottom, and I held on the rod. I'm all of probably 12, 13 years old. And so anyway, I'm holding on it, and it starts to shake. And anyway, then the chills go down your spine,
Yeah, you get super
and
excited.
yeah. So we landed that, and I was blown away. And again, hindsight, keeping these big fish, hindsight's always 20/20. But in that particular time, in my selfish early teen years, I was like, I got to take that home to show off, right? So we kept it, and I was still like, I was a mess. I was shaking, and so I said, and the eel was dead. It had killed the eel, but the eel was still on the hook.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I gave the rod to Dad, and I said, "Here, you take the rod. I'll run the motor." And it wasn't 10 minutes later, and he outdid me by like 12 pounds. It was ridiculous. So we had these two monster fish. I think might even been early November back then. But anyway, it was just crazy. We still have the pictures. I'll try and put a few pictures up, and if you got a couple from your
Yeah, I'll
like
try
your
to send you.
yeah a couple from your highlight reel, that would be awesome.
Yeah, I'll try to send you some down for sure. No, it's a lot of good memories fishing upriver, fishing. We trolled,
Amazing.
we fished some eels, and the eels were always hard to get. And
Yeah.
so we didn't put a ton of effort into trapping them and stuff, but some guys do. The guys who put the effort in, you're gonna catch big fish consistently with those for sure. There's no question. We did troll the old rubber eels a lot, the old Burt Jigadoo eels. We caught a lot of nice fish on those from small to big, and places up off of the mouth of Michelle Brook, which is in First Bay, and then Round Hill Brook in Second Bay, and then opposite of Round Hill Brook on the other side of Second Bay. I'm sure they're gone now if I was to go up there now, but there used to be a bunch of pylons in the water there from an old schooner wharf, and where the schooners used to dock when they come up river for apples. And then we used to get a lot of fish along there, trolling plugs and eels and stuff like that. So, just a lot of and Round Hill Brook used to produce a lot of big fish. So
Yeah,
it
I
was a nice
remember.
flat at the mouth of Round Hill Brook.
Yeah, I remember going to Round Hill and seeing the guys fishing the live Gaspro at different times. But I never, I don't know as much about the specific landscape between there and down to the causeway. Most of my time was spent standing right on the causeway throwing bucktails, or mostly bucktails, really, or Cisco kids.
Well, bucktails were the main, those bucktails were our go-to forever. 2 ounce spearhead bucktails with a tip with a rubber worm. That was the main. And then we'd use big Rapellas, big Cisco kids, run out in the current and the fast water and stuff. And then later years, we realized that we'd have different times of the year where, you know, casting the bucktails are the bigger plugs because everybody always thinks big bait, big fish and all that kind of stuff, which is, you know, which is generally true. But there's times of year stripers can be as fussy as trout.
Oh yeah.
And be, you know, very prey specific. So we would go through, sometimes we would go through 2 weeks stretch, solid fishing day and night, not have
nothing,
any left, no bumps, no nothing. And then after a while we started to realize, well, there's different things going on.
Yeah.
At those times there's a smaller bait fish prevalent, or the crabs were peeling their shells, and that's the favorite of stripers. When the crabs molt their shells, it becomes soft. The stripers will seek them out and root them out, and, you know, just so different stuff. So what we realized later on was, you know, we can't always throw the 2 ounce bucktail or the 8 and 10 ounce plug. Sometimes you've got to, you know, you've got to mix it up. So I've caught some pretty big fish on, you know, bucktail jigs as small as 1/4 ounce.
Really?
You know, off the Navy dock there, 10-pound test line, and it, the smallest. One time, I went one of some of the last years we went down there to fish. The biggest fish on the smallest rod I ever caught down there was off the old Navy dock, where the cadets used to.
And
we used to fish. Well, we always cast bucktails off because you get all the back swirl from the gates of the fast water. So we'd always cast the bucktails out there, and we always did really well, but. But in there you could do some other stuff. So I caught a 10 pounder on a 5 foot ultralight freshwater spinner on 4 pound test.
No way.
So that's kind of the biggest fish on the smallest rod ever.
That's
caught down there. And it was, it was kind of a challenge because what I had to do was I started doing it. We had these small jigs, but what happened if I set the drag on my reel tight enough that it wouldn't strip when I tried to reel a fish when I got it on.
Yeah.
As soon as the fish on the line would snap. So what I ended up having to do was I had to set my drag as tight as I could set it so that it wouldn't slip when I reeled the fish. But I had to turn the anti-reverse off
I
could reel backwards. So you really had to play the fish, and you could land them pretty quick that way. But what you had to do when you could sense the fish wanted to run, you had to back reel. And you fed him line under tension. Then when he stopped, you could pump him, work him, get him in. And then when he wanted to go again, then you back reel him. Go, you know what I mean?
So you kind of
fed him line that way. So biggest fish I ever got was a 10-pound striper. So
on a 4-pound test, man, that's that
4-pound test mono. Yeah,
that I don't know. That might have been an IGFA record back then.
So it was pretty crazy. It's pretty extreme. Yeah. It's not something you're going to want to do, but it was, at the time I just wanted to try.
Different
things. I don't know how old I was at that time. Probably in my early 20s, I guess. At that time, you want to try all this different stuff.
And
by that time too, we were also fly fishing for them as well. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Not many people had fly rods down there, and that was something I never did. Well, I never was even into fly fishing until my mid-20s, and I wasn't living down there. But I have experienced stripers on the fly a couple times, and it's amazing.
They're fun to catch on the fly.
Yeah, sure. I mean, other than jumping out of the water like a salmon, which they don't do, other than that, they have a very distinct, run and pull and head shake, and it's a good time.
Oh, and the hit.
Yeah, and the hit, that's right.
The hit when they take is probably one of the hardest hits that you're going to find in any fish.
For sure.
It's in the hit and then the fight. I mean, the bigger the striper get, the less they fight, the less they run. But if you get a striper between 10 and 20 pounds, those are going to be your hardest fighters, I always found. And they just bulldog, they rip, they tear, they go, and the hit. I mean, sometimes they would hit and it would just scare you. Like it was.
Oh, yeah.
The take would be almost scary, especially at night, because you're just going along and all of a sudden it's just like a train just hit whatever it was you're fishing. And there's been a lot of times stripers, as you know, will have a tendency to hit almost at your feet.
I was just gonna say, I know I can remember a handful of times when I'm reeling in a plug, and I don't know if you guys used much for wire leaders back then.
We did early on, and then I went to making my own mono leaders. And then at the end, like probably the last several years, I didn't use any leader unless there was a specific reason that I need to, because of structure.
Or yeah, yeah, yeah.
Bucktails, I would, the bucktail jigs I would tie direct. Rappellas, I put a staff swivel on, but that would be about it.
Okay, cool. Yeah, because one area that we used to fish a lot, which wasn't right in Annapolis, there were some old bridge abutments, and as soon as you hooked one, it would head out around there, right? I remember specifically, you know, once I think the leader actually, like, it was probably a 2-foot leader. It actually hit the end of my rod because it's pitch black, and sometimes you don't know until it's right there. And then a fish took it right there, and, you know, it's gone.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've seen guys, I remember my brother one time at the Navy dock, we were fishing there, bucktails, and we were catching some fish, and he reeled in, and he was lifting his bucktail out of the water. Bucktail was probably 2 feet out of the water, and this 6-pound striper came up out of the water and grabbed it.
No way. I've never seen
that. In
the
air and back down.
That's amazing.
It went in the water. So I've seen all kinds of crazy stuff like that.
That is nuts for sure. Now, I know right now, when I've driven through there, you know, they've got fences everywhere and do not enter. I don't know what the rules are exactly. So Danny and I are probably getting people listening all gigged up, and, you know, somebody might go down and try. The rules are different now.
I don't know what I was last time I was down there was, would have been 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. When my wife and I got our chocolate lab, we got it from a breeder out in Lakeel.
Right.
And when I drove down there, it was like, tons of memories coming back, and it was, but to me, I mean, there was people going around driving on the road, but to me it was like a ghost town.
Yes.
There was nobody fishing.
No.
Right. And it was just like
very weird. Yeah,
I had been telling my wife about this place, and she said, you know, this is where I was like, and she looked at me. She's like, why do you have that look on your face? And
yeah.
I was kind of sad in a way because said, it's like a ghost town here right now. I said, you know, I said, you used to see, you know, somebody over here, there'd be 2 cars parked over there. There'd be somebody down at that point. There'd be somebody in the fast water here, and there'd be 3 cars. And, you know, Cyril Brown be out in First Bay with his looking for the aluminum boat, and his dog Jet would be standing up on the bow. You know?
Rex Taylor would be on the turbine side.
So it's, you know, but there were, like, to your point, there was fences everywhere.
Yeah.
Places on the outside of the causeway where the boat shed was. Mm-hmm. I mean, where we used to drive down, it's completely fenced off. You can't even get down there now.
Yeah.
I noticed on the inside, it's not fenced off as much. I have no idea what they'd say to you now if you went to go down. I've often been thinking about going down and trying it, but I don't know how much trouble I'd get in there.
I think you and I should try and do that next summer. You know, just go down and give it a try for a day or so.
I'd like to do that. I've been thinking about it for the last few years and just never acted on it.
Yeah, I mean, even if the fish are not there, or, you know, there's not nearly as many, it would be quite something to do.
There's got to be still some fish.
I would think so.
You know, like a lot of guys say there's none, but there's got to be something there. And the other thing with that fishery was a lot of people at the back end of when I was fishing there, a lot of the new people coming in didn't fish the spots.
Oh, yeah.
Right. You know, when we were learning those spots, if you're going to fish the fast water or the hole or the inside out or whatever it was, I mean, there's a specific
pin rock
way that you fish those spots, pin rock or Rex's rock or the Navy dock or whatever. And there's a specific way you fish those spots. And there's specific tides that you would fish those spots. And there's specific, you would fish, you know, pin rock. If these gates were open, you would fish the Navy dock. Gates were open. And you would fish it for this section of the tide.
Exactly.
You wouldn't fish it for the whole tide. You would fish it for the first 40 minutes
or
whatever it was, and then you would move somewhere else. At near the end, what we noticed was a lot of new people coming in weren't following that, you know, those
system,
ways, and those were ways that, you know, we obviously learned when we went there, and also we developed some of those spots too.
Sure.
I mean, so we had, you know, I fished there long enough that, you know, my dad and I learned from a lot of the other guys that cut their teeth there on how certain spots would fish. But then we also developed some of our old spots. Like, we used to do a thing called fishing the inside out, which was we'd fish the opposite side of the tide. So if the tide was running out and the tidal plant was generating and the gates were flowing water out towards Granville Ferry, we would come back on the inside on the Dunroman side and we'd fish those points where the current's got to suck around those points.
That's a good idea. That's something that we never did.
And we used to catch a ton of fish. For example, on the generator side, if you were looking out towards Dunroman, if you fished the left side and on the outer point outside the boom, that was a lot deeper on that side. And when you get fish on fishing the inside out on that side, they were always big fish. If you fish the opposite point, if you fish the right bank, which is the bank between the generator and the gates, that side was really shallow. And there was a huge mussel flat that swept around that point. And so what we used to do there was we would, and we fly fish that side some because the bank was low enough that you could actually do it. But what it was, or usually we'd fish bucktails or if we fish spinning gear there. And what you would do is, and the current, tremendous amount of current
it's
there.
Crazy.
It's almost scary how much
it
current
is scary.
Around that when they're generating.
Yeah.
And so what you would do is you cast your bucktail out and you let it, and the current would just carry it along, a 2 ounce bucktail to sweep it along like it was
nothing,
but it was heavy enough that it would bounce.
Yeah.
So what you would do is it would hit the bottom. You could feel it hitting the mussel bed.
Nice.
And when it hit, you would pump it or jig it.
Yeah.
And that would pull it back up in the column, and then the current would take it so far, and then it would bounce again. So you would just be bouncing. And a lot of times there, it would be like, you know, bounce, 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 bang. Kind of fish, right? So the fish average smaller over there. The other point, we used to catch 30 and 40 pounders regular. Most of the fish on the shallower side were in the 10 to 25 pound range with the occasional big one that was up, but stripers love to root on mussel flats. Those mussel flats have a lot of dips and depression. So the stripers will feed a lot like trout do in a river. The trout in a river, they find they have lies and feeding stations and they sit there and they let the current, the river
do the work.
Their food conveyor belt. And they do, and the river does the work for them, brings them the food. They dart out and get this bug, that bug, whatever. Stripers do the same thing, ambush bait fish that can't swim in that heavy current, or crabs or whatever else gets caught in that current. They'll lay in these depressions on these shallows and or in the rock crevices or whatever, and they'll just wait for it to come by. And they're an ambush predator just like a trout is, and their body's built for that. And so we developed a lot of different kind of spots like that. And, you know, had a lot of fun doing that. And like I said, it was kind of weird to go down there and not see anybody fishing the spot.
It is. It's like there's a very eerie, sad, almost a sadness, right? So I think we should do something about that for sure. Yeah, the two of us or bring our families or something, and you know they can go to Upper Clements Park and we'll go fishing.
Absolutely, it sounds good to me.
But I should point out, if anybody's listening and you actually do go down there and try. When we look back on this, it was incredibly dangerous. I mean, my father, he's very cautious in everything, especially when it came to us kids. But for some reason, when it came to striped bass fishing, I mean, you know, he'd make sure that, you know, I was safe. But, you know, especially like you said, you know, there's a system to it, and there's almost like a salmon rotation, like a salmon pool rotation when you were fishing the super fast water.
Absolutely.
You know, you get in line, guy in the front would cast the plug out, let it scream out for, you know, 30, 60 seconds, something like that. And then, and then walk over, fish a little bit, reel it in, and everybody would kind of go through that. But I mean, we're talking like, you know, midnight, 2 o'clock in the morning.
Oh yeah.
Pitch black sometimes, no moon or rain or whatever, and you're walking along. It's no wonder they have fences and signs, you know, do not trespass. Probably a safety thing. But
well, it would be a safety thing for sure,
I mean, and like you said, didn't you even were there when some guy fell in or something?
Oh yeah, I've seen guys fall in. I mean, and I've seen guys that probably should have fallen in. I mean, one of the things, like, of course, when I was younger, I didn't have, you know, the adult pops and stuff, but but one of the, you know, I've seen lots of guys over there,
lots of
fishing that were just completely had way
inebriated.
Too many pops.
Guys
that probably should have fallen in but didn't. I've seen guys that fell in on the edge and were able to get out. I had some once myself where I almost fell in fishing the outside fast water. I was landing this fish that was about 14 pounds. I was fishing there all by myself. And I went to get the fish and slipped on some of the rock weed. And the water was coming out of the gate pretty heavy. And I I never lost a fish.
Yeah.
I held the rod in one hand. I managed to grab a rock with my other hand, and my feet were beaten in the bath water.
Man, you were lucky.
And I pulled myself around and got myself up and landed the fish. And
yeah.
Then that was, I realized afterwards, like how
close that was.
How close that was. But,
yeah.
I mean, and then also even fishing Pinrock.
Mm-hmm.
And when Pinrock was rolling really good, you used to have to wade out to Pinrock.
Yeah.
Because the outer pin for the boom was out on that rock point.
And right.
You would wade out at certain times almost up to your waist and stand on these slick rocks. And you're standing. When it, originally, to fish Pinrock the way Pinrock used to be fished, you used to stand out on the pin.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
The boom where the boom was, and that's why it was called Pin Rock, and because you would stand on the pin. I'll try to get a picture here.
Yeah,
I'll try to put that to you. Of somebody in a really early morning tide standing on the pin, and you'll be seeing the picture that he's about 10, 12 feet from shore, and it's like a little rock spine that ran over the bank. You'd walk out on the rocks and wade your way in through the rocks, and you'd stand on this big rock. And the pin for the boom was actually physically driven into this rock, and that's why it was called Pin Rock.
Yeah,
and that
was
the rock that you would stand on, and you would cast out into the fast water current and let your bucktail, usually a bucktail, sometimes a plug, there swing. But I mean, you were at times when you were fishing, and you'd be fishing that at 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, and that water used to just hiss, right?
Oh, and the boom would just
be
slat.
Slapping.
Yeah.
Right?
It's scary.
And the water would just have this almost like a hissing sound, like
yep.
all the time.
And, mm-hmm.
and you'd be standing out on this, and I'm standing out on this rock at like 10, 11, 12, 13 years old.
That's insane.
Sometimes you would never think. Hindsight, my son's 10 years old now.
You wouldn't put him out on there.
I don't know that I would put him out on that rock, but, I don't know.
It doesn't mean our, our fathers were reckless or anything. It was just what you did, right?
It was just a different time. I certainly didn't get, my dad didn't put me out on that rock.
Mm. you're going out on that rock, Danny. Yeah.
No, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like when we started fishing that spot, like, and the first time I fished that rock certainly wasn't at 2 o'clock in the morning.
No.
I mean, there was multiple trips in the daylight on a soft tide before in calm conditions and how to wade out and what the path was to it. And so
mm-hmm.
that, exactly how to get there. And so in the dark, you can actually feel, because one of the other things that my dad and I never did a lot, we never used flashlights a lot.
Right.
A lot of guys did. A lot of guys would use lanterns. And
yeah,
like
we
that.
Did.
And,
yeah.
And we used them to a minimum.
Yeah.
Only when it was absolutely necessary.
Yeah.
So for getting around these spots, it was really about learning them in the daylight, so that it was, by the time you go there to fish these night tides, which are always the most productive, you knew exactly what was what.
Yeah, exactly.
And that wouldn't be unlike fishing night brown trout now, which is coming to kind of vogue the last number of seasons now, and which is something that we did a long time ago too, before a lot of people knew about it or were into it, but. That was born out of striped bass fishing.
Oh, nice.
Or flipping that, realizing we could make that a very effective way to chase brown trout, came from striped bass. That
awesome.
Was born from, for us, from was born from striped bass fishing, and now it's a very popular thing. But it's the same thing. If you're going to night brown trout fish, whether you're fishing spinning gear or fly, you better know
what you're doing, where you are going.
Because with brown trout, it's even more critical not to use a light. The less you can use a light, the better off you're going to be. So you need to know where you're going.
For
safety, a lot of these things.
Yeah, brown trout are, I think, even more skittish, right? And I mean, we always used to hear that, light can attract the bait fish, and therefore the stripers would come in. We never really experienced that, but we did use lanterns, especially when I was the youngest. And what we had people yell at us to turn them off. I'd say, turn that off. Yeah, and I think Dad argued back a few times, but we also did a lot of our fishing in the daytime, especially initially. I mean, it's scary scary enough around the water, the speed of the water there. And actually, I still have my very first striped bass I have on the wall.
That's awesome.
But it's It's not big. And Dad lucked out because he said after I think he had caught two. I think he had caught a 9 pound one in one of our first outings, and then like a 20 pounder a few weeks later. And he said, the first one you get, I'll mount, because I was starting to get cranky because I hadn't even hooked one. And he's like, the first one you catch, I'll get it mounted. And I was thinking, cool, it's going to be this big one. And we were down on the Navy dock one night. There were
Oh, nice.
two other guys there from the Knoll Shore. I think one guy's name was Gary Gorham. Gary
I
Gorman.
have
Yeah,
Gary, yeah.
he used to drive that little Suzuki Sidekick or something. Anyway, he used to drive that around. They were quite good anglers. Probably one of the inebriated ones. And
Yeah, he
so,
was early on.
oh yeah. So anyway, they were super nice guys. I was down the wharf, and they were already there, so we didn't want to impose. But they were like, "Oh, come on down." And they saw me, this little kid with like a 10-foot surf rod, didn't know what I was doing. So they said, go ahead, throw it out." And I caught this literally like a 2.5 pound striper, and I knew I had a fish on, but it didn't feel very big, of course, on the rod that I had. So I got it in, and that was my first one ever. I think it was 22 inches long. It's still on the wall, mounted on a nice piece of wood, kind of thing. But
That's awesome.
so lots of good fishing to be had. I just tell people, even though there's concerns about what impact they may or may not have on other species, it wasn't that long ago when, there really weren't many of these fish around. So enjoy them, but don't abuse it. I keep hearing these stories of people everywhere, and it's disgusting. I can't stand it.
Oh, there's a
Just
lot of that going on.
filling buckets with tiny fish, and or keeping, well beyond the limit. We don't have a lot of law enforcement resources when it comes to that stuff, but if you see that happening, call the number in the front of the regulation book, because
Absolutely.
it's just, it's frustrating, and we tend to do that as humans. I think, if something's going good, we'll abuse it until it's not, right?
Well, that's kind of the way it goes. I don't even want to say it's human nature, it's human habit to do those things. And it's and with striped bass right now, that kind of falls into two camps. It falls into camp one. A lot of people just think, well, there's a lot of them, so we're just going to take whatever we want, and it's not going to matter. And then the other camp right now is does fall into that salmon stuff, and a lot of people, like, literally
They're treating
hate
them,
that species.
yeah,
They
treat,
treat them like a trash fish, and
yeah.
they're doing whatever it is, and that's, that's people's prerogative.
Yeah.
I think it's a misguided notion. Everybody's certainly entitled to their opinion. And at one point in my salmon management career, I was kind of a similar mindset, not necessarily towards striped bass, but I was of the mindset of, salmon is the most important fish, and we shouldn't do this, and we shouldn't do that, and it should have precedent over this, and it should have precedent over that. But at one point, I remember being at a meeting, and I remember talking to a senior biologist, and one of the things we talked about the importance of doing things to conserve salmon and stuff like that, and then he's but when they what he said one of the things he said to me struck me was, he said, you know, these aren't the sacred cow, and meaning they're not the only thing that's out there, and they're not the only thing that matters. And he was one of and that kind of changed my
Yeah,
thought
sure.
process, because my thought process had evolved, into starting to think that that was the only species that mattered. And salmon is certainly an important species, or a huge part of our heritage, and everything like that. But that kind of changed my thinking around, and it's put my thinking around to being more of, you know what, like the only thing that matters the most is our overall environmental health. And if our overall environmental health is the way it should be, and our habitats are the way it should be, and we're not stripping everything off, and not dumping chemicals and polluting and destroying habitat on a grand scale, then things won't decline as much as they are, and things will, you know, turn around.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, I think in the way, really, I think that's the way our thinking should be on a lot of that stuff, because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what species you're talking about, if it's experiencing some sort of issue, human beings, if they want an answer as to what the issue is, they really just need to look in a mirror.
Oh, yeah.
Human
absolutely.
Beings that are the problem. And yeah. The good news is on this, though, it's, these are all human-induced problems, and they have human-induced solutions. And
yeah.
part of that solution is not meddling. It's been proven mm-hmm. over and over. The more we meddle, the more problems we make. So it's, mm-hmm. you know, but we're certainly in a unique time, that's for sure.
It is, you know, just, you know, the other day, you know, I mean, you're always hearing about, you know, carbon emissions and whatever, and, you know, we should be, you know, certain countries and cities are determined to have electric cars only by certain years and all this. And we're walking around town here, you know, we walk around regularly and just looking around and we're like, nobody's changing, you know, we're driving as much or more than ever. Mm-hmm. We're on our phones. We're just, you know, it's like we know there's a problem, but all we want to do is point a quick finger to the nearest, you know, thing that we think we can have an impact on. And that's what I think the striped bass are in this case. And so, you know, hopefully people listening find this informative. I know I value your opinion greatly. You've got a lot more you know, restoration and environmental work under your belt than I do, than probably most people listening. And so I think that provides some good insight on this. And definitely we should work towards getting back to our striper grounds and seeing what happens down there sometime.
That'd be fun. Just, you know, we'll talk about it and, you know, plan. We used to try to plan trips around full moons and big tides.
Yes.
So maybe we can make something like that happen.
Absolutely. All right, Danny, I really appreciate your time today, and thanks for joining.
My pleasure, Dave. Hi, have a good day, buddy.
You too. Thanks. All right, so again, I want to thank Danny for taking the time to talk with me today, go down memory lane. And if you want to find the show notes for today's episode, again, just go to maritimeoutdoorsman.com/025. In there, I'll have a link to Danny's website and more information. So thanks again for listening. Take care and have a great day.